top of it to keep, anybody out of the out of the railroad yard, you know, that wasn't. It wasn't loyal, you know. Right. Oh, they have a they've got a very delicate way now, you know, in the kept press in our free press now of referring to scabs, you know. Nowadays they don't call them scabs anymore, you know. They call them non-strikers or loyal employees. Yeah, that's the way they refer in I believe it was in a copy of this San Francisco Examiner this morning. I read that where some of the striking Western Union employees had overturned an auto in front of the Western Union plant back east somewheres. This auto, it said, belonged to one of the non-striking employees.
When they have to write ahead, they won't fool with a long word like that.
The IWW didn't make contracts. They didn't believe in making contracts with the boss.
Oh, I heard Vincent saying, and John one time elaborate on that. He said that the Hartshoffner and Marx people were having a terrific beef, you know, with the Amalgamated Clothing Workers with the United Garment Workers, the AFL outfit, which later on split and became the Amalgamated Clothing Workers. And the Hartshoffner and Marx, they have a big clothing factory, you know, in Chicago, as you probably well know. And they were having a beef with this AFL outfit, the United Garment Workers. And I don't know whether somebody played a practical joke or not on one of the Marx brothers, but anyways, Vincent St. John said the telephone rang in general headquarters of the IWW, and lo and behold, it's one of the big wheels of the Hartshoffner, and Marx wants to know whether it'll be possible for he, Vincent St. John, is the General Secretary Treasurer of the Industrial Workers of the World, to come down and organize his employees. And Vincent St. John said, he explained to this fellow over the phone, he said, well, ordinarily, he said, we don't go down and organize, he said, a plant, he said, of any factory or any of the workers, he said, by permission of the employers, he said. We don't do business that way, he said. We organize the workers at their request. If they wish to become members of our organization, he said, it's okay with us. But he said, no, none of this business, he said, of forcing workers into the industrial workers of the world. Then this big wheel of the Amalgamated or the United Garment Workers, he wanted to know, he inquired from Vincent St. John, well, does your labor organization sign a contract if you do organize our workers? And Vincent St. John had to disillusion him on that point. He said, no, he said, our organization doesn't sign any contract. He said, because if we do sign a contract, that ties our hands for the time being, and if we see an opportunity to get more than what we got the last time we went round and round with the bosses, he said, why, the contract ties our hands. He said, nothing.
How about getting back to Fresno and going on with that story?
Did you go down to San Diego then?
Oh, no, after I was practically driven from Fresno by a blacklist, I couldn't find employment of any sort. I decided that I'd go back to the Pacific Northwest to the Puget Sound again. And of course, I went back the same way that I came down. I beat my way back to the Puget Sound up to Seattle, Washington. And then shortly after I was back in Seattle, I tried to grab a handful of boxcars out of Seattle, and I slipped and fell and underneath the train. That's how I met with the accident, you know. I wear an artificial limb.
Oh,
well, of course, that hampered my style a whole lot. Plus the fact that I was pretty well fed up on this passive resistance business through my experience in the Fresno Free Speech Fight. I decided that from then on, why, there wasn't going to be any more fire hoses or any more clubbing all on one side. That if they gave me a fighting break, why, it was okay, but this passive resistance idea didn't go so good with me.
Does anybody believe in passive resistance? Only when they were in jail.
Well, that's practically what it amounted to. In other words, you get up and make a speech. Fellow workers, I'm speaking in behalf of the spirit of the Constitution and all that sort of thing, the Bill of Rights. You keep on talking till the minion of the law comes along and collars you, and then off to the jailhouse you go. Well, that's passive resistance.
How long did you talk that time down there in Fresno as the next in line?
About 2 minutes. The big 200-pound deputy bore down on me and shook me like a terrier, you know. There was I guess I told you about that. There was a young fellow there in the crowd. He became quite indignant. A youngster just about, I believe, the age of your Benny over here, you know. He told old Chief Shaw, he said, "Let go of that man." He said, "He isn't resisting arrest." He said, "What do you have to use him so rough for?" He said to this deputy. "And he isn't resisting arrest." And old Chief Shaw, you know, he had one of these chin whiskers, you know, that would go up and down, you know, like that. When he got excited, he screamed, "Take him along too, take him along too," you know. So they took this young fellow and threw him in the bucket. Well, it turned out that his father owned one of the biggest planing mills that was in Fresno. And of course, by the time he got down to the jailhouse, why, his father and his father's lawyer was down there, you know, to bail him out. But after the Free Speech Fight was over and we reopened our headquarters, why, he looked me up one day and he took out a card in our organization. And then he said, "My God," he said, "I want you to come down to that planting mill," he said, "that my dad owns," he says, "and if those so-and-sos," he says, "down there don't join you in our organization," he says, "I'll have Dad fired." Of course, I had to disillusion him on that, you know. I had to patiently explain to him that we didn't organize that way, you know.
We had different classes.
But for a little time, he had some glory. He fought for free speech, too.
Yeah.
He protested. You got the whole story pretty well? From what?
Yes, it's wonderful.
That's a wonderful story.
It all goes together. It could really make a book, the whole free speech fight.
You mean San Diego and today?
Well, they went all, no, well, yes, and today, but they went all over. I mean, like,
this way.
Yeah.
He had been in a fight and he was a wounded veteran of the fight.
Thanks, Ward.
And so, what did the Wobblies do? Just kind of ignore you, or what did they do? This was nice. When he lost his leg after he went back to the Fresno Free Speech Fight, so then what happened, Harry?
Well, after I met with the accident, why, the local in Tacoma and also in Seattle, why, they contributed to a fund to sort of help me bridge the gap between the time that I became accustomed to this handicap that I was laboring under and eventually, why, of course, as soon as I was able to make a living for myself, why, I asked, I didn't ask nor did I expect any help from my fellow workers. There was a sort of a camaraderie, a sort of a brotherhood, you might say, among the industrial workers of the world that you never have found or never will find, I believe, among the trade unions. If you were a member of the industrial workers of the world and you dropped into an IWW hall, there wasn't any this business of caste or this business of because you happened to be from a different part of the United States or any other part of the world. You were accepted on terms of equality by the boys, and you had that feeling of brotherhood in the real sense of the word. The IWW men used to help each other out during times of adversity instead of this business like you find among the AFL and the craft union, this hurrah for me and the hell with the other guy. And eventually, of course, after I became more or less reconciled to my lot, you might say, after meeting with this terrible accident, why, eventually I began to rationalize the thing. I picked the pieces up where I figured they should fit in, and I just simply made the best of it. But among my fellow workers and among those who understood, why, they didn't ask you whether you were a veteran of the Yanko-Spanko War or any other baloney. They recognized you as being a veteran in the class war. And even today, with what few outposts there are left of the IWW, you still find that spirit among them. There's the thing that I think that wrecked the IWW was, I can't go along with the idea that the anarcho-syndicalist element were the ones who wrecked the IWW. I think that our organization was too intellectually in its concepts, in its idealism, was about 50 years in advance of the intelligence, you might say, that we had a right to expect among the working class. In other words, we were trying to bring about the brotherhood of man at a time when the workers didn't even know what the brotherhood of man concept was.
Do you think the working class will understand it?
Well, you have more general class consciousness among the workers all the world over now than what you had at that time.
Well, I mean right here in the United States.
Well, that's a moot question. That's a good question.
Well, you didn't say, well, what happened about up in Portland? Now, didn't they ask you to be secretary of the local ed?
Oh, I was one night, to my great surprise, I was voted in as secretary of the lumber workers local in Portland, Oregon. I forget the number of the local, it's been so many long years, but anyways, it, you might say the boys sort of favored the Tammany Hall idea, and they figured that I needed the job and that it was a desk job and that I had the qualifications, and instead of getting out and wrestling for a living in a cruel, hostile world, they'd take care of me for a while.
I don't think Tammany would have worried about the qualifications.
Hmm?
No, they
Big
didn't.
Pardon?
I don't think Tammany Hall would have worried about the qualifications.
Oh no, you rang the bell on that one, Ben.
Well, then,
as a matter of fact, when I was working in a, in 1925, I took I happened to be in New York, and I took it. I was given a Tammany Hall job, and the point of civil service job, some of the fellows that were working with me in this big grain elevator and on the docks there, they didn't know they didn't even know what a dock looked like before. Several of them, while I was working for the Bureau of Canals, they'd clock in the morning and shortly afterward they'd disappear and nobody'd see them. They didn't even bother about clocking out at night. They had they had the foreman clock them out.
That was after your accident that they made you secretary of the local in Portland.
At how much a week? At how much a week?
The munificent remuneration was $15 a week.
I was a national organizer. I got $18.
But that's your week. That was the pay.
That was merely a part of technique or efficiency. The IWW was very efficient. Desk jobs had to go to people that couldn't get out and do the rough work out down the road. So therefore, you had to have a desk job. They were just being efficient. It wasn't because they were
Well, it was a sort of a beneficent idea, too. I mean, the general consensus of opinion among the boys was that we got to take, we've got to try to take care of some of our own casualties.
But I think it's true, though. The IWW had something that we don't have today. I mean, they had a feeling, or a fearless feeling for each other. And sometimes we don't have
solidarity.
And we don't have a love for each other. We have a certain a fear of having that. Even in the left, you know, we don't have that.
Well, Howard Fast comes the closest to giving a delineation of that idea in that book that he wrote within recent time called Spartacus. He goes on to show the way, of course, he had your, even Spartacus among his revolting gladiators and his revolting slaves that made up his command, there were, of course, weak sisters that, you know, buckled and bent under and gave away. But I like the way Howard Fast outlined the thing in that book, called Spartacus. He said these were desperate men. He said men, he said, who had no alternative except to fight and fight and fight to the bitter end of death itself. Well, you might say that that was exactly the spirit that you found among the IWW. In other words, they were the ones, the worker, the migratory worker, was spat upon, was despised by the home guards, by the local town clown, and we used to call the marshal and the deputy sheriffs and the cops in the cities and in the towns. If they found a red card on a fellow, in a good many cases they'd give him a working over, as they used to call it, just on general principles. And the result was the tougher they made it for the boys, why, the more cohesiveness, the more solidarity there was among these workers that, to my notion, were in the vanguard at that time of the fight.
Well, you know, in the Middle West, you couldn't get a freight car unless you had a red card.
Right. Carrying a card?
Well,
over
the
in the
way you could ride a freight car.
Well, there were some.
They controlled and organized the whole movement of the freight.
Ray Schultz, you know, he was a brakeman for a good big part of the time, and even as a member of the BRT, you know, he had, of course, he carried a card in the Brotherhood of Railroad Trainmen. He said that on the trains that he was on, he said if the guy didn't carry at least a trade union card, he didn't ride, as far as Ray was concerned. But he said, preferably a red car.
They say, what are you riding on?
Another remarkable thing, I think, in the IWW was their education. I really don't think that we have topped that yet. I mean, the tremendous pamphlets and schools and educational programs that they had. I mean, the tremendous amount of literature that they distributed. You know, from people just having it in their pockets.
Well, it was the voice, you might say, it was the voice, you might say, of the worker who up to that time had been inarticulate. In other words, there was, as I said before, no labor organization from the Knights of Labor, from what I've been able to understand, Ben, made a splendid start along that line of trying to organize the unorganized. But they, of course, didn't have the scientific outline, you know, the scientific way of going at the thing. They were creating mass organizations, you know, with the idea in mind of organizing the unorganized. But the American Scabration of Labor and these other AFL outfits, they have never made any attempt to organize the unskilled. Up to the time you might say of the CIO, the Congress of Industrial Organization, when that organization and a good many of their most active organizers, even John L. Lewis afterward acknowledged, were some of them that were the formerly despised IWW men. Along with the communists, he said they made the best organizers among the unorganized.
Up until the CIO, there's never been such an articulation of political consciousness from Texas up to Minnesota, Dakotas, and into Oregon and Montana. You know, I mean, it was a tremendous thing from 1988 to the First World War.
The IWW preamble was the thing that the master class, that the employers didn't like, was the way they didn't pull any punches. If I remember the preamble correctly, Ben, it went like this: the working class and the employing class have nothing in common. There can be no peace so long as hunger and want are found among millions of working people, and the few who make up the employing class have all the good things of life. Between these two classes, the struggle must go on until the workers of the world organize as a class, take possession of the earth and the machinery of production, and abolish the wage system. We find that the sundering of the management of industry into fewer and fewer hands makes the trade unions unable to cope with the ever-growing power of the employing class. The trade unions foster a state of affairs where one set of workers is pitted against another set of workers, both in the same industry, thereby defeating one another in wage wars. See, these conditions can be changed, and the interest of the working class upheld only by an organization formed in such a way that all the members of that industry or other industries, down tools whenever a strike or a lockout is affected in any of the industries, thus making an injury to one an injury to all. By organizing industrially, we are forming the structure of the new society within the shell of the old. You see, and Lenin himself, in that book called Revolution, he goes on to show the way, the thing that the Bolsheviks instinctively turned to at the time of the Russian Revolution were the unions of the Russian workers. 'Tis true that only 15% of the Russian proletariat were in industry, but the way Bob Miner outlined the thing when he came back from Russia, he said, you didn't have to tell the Russian worker. You didn't have to scream at him until he was black in the face to tell him that he was oppressed, that he was a wage slave. He knew it. He said, every strike that took place, he said, almost spontaneously the red flag appeared. And he said, it became a miniature rehearsal for the one big strike, the social general strike.
Okay, now, since you want labor history, what are we going to do now? You want to stop that? Is Ben going to give you something?
Say some poems, your favorite poems.
Well, the one that I was afraid to sing before the poetry club here in San Francisco was the one that appeared in Bishop William Montgomery Brown's Communism and Christianism. This poem, the author of whom I believe was anonymous, unknown, why...
That great author, one of the greatest authors in the world.
Bishop Brown had this poem in his book, but it went like this. Have you ever been to Crazy Land, down on the Lunatic Pike? There are the queerest sort of people there, you never saw the like. The ones who do the useful work are poor as poor can be, and those who do no useful work all live in luxury. They raise so much in Crazy Land of food and clothes and such that those who work don't have enough because they raise too much. They're wrong side too in Crazy Land. They're upside down with care. They walk around upon their heads with feet up in the air. One poem that I remember when I was my younger and more idealistic-minded youth was one that it was a parody on that some tripe that Boneyard Kipling had written, you know, the Cry of England. This unknown worker wrote this poem. It went like this. Let's see if I can remember. We have fed you all for a thousand years, and you hail us still unfed, though there's never a dollar of all your wealth but marks the workers dead. There's never a mine blown skyward now, but we're buried alive for you. There's never a wreck this shoreward now, but we are its ghastly crew. Go reckon our dead by forges red and factories where we spin. And if blood be the price of your cursed wealth, good God, we have brought it in. We have fed you all for a thousand years, for that was our doom, you know, from the days when you chained us in your fields to the strike of a week ago. You have eaten our lives and our babes and wives, and we're told it's our legal share. But if blood be the price of your cursed wealth, good God, we have bought it fair.
You like that?
Yeah,
you
know that? No,
I don't. I can. I've heard.
That's
the IWW.
Oh, is it?
The old Redwood.
I got
Redwood.
The old song
for
Carrie brought out. I can't find it around.
Is that Bernard Anonymous?
The author is unknown, but he wrote it, you know, in answer to that tripe that Rudyard Kipling wrote about the Cry of England, you know.
What other poems do you recall that?
Do you write any yourself?
I made a splurge.
Spiders and poets.
I made a splurge on it.
Somebody ought to make a collection of the poetry and short stories in the old IWW magazine. They're really wonderful. Or the satire.
No one's ever done it, huh?
I don't think so. The satire, it's really a great... Or go through Oscar Evering's paper on the Appeal to Reason.
Mm-hmm.
And the old newspaper. You know, it would really be a contribution to do.
Get into the file.
solidarity.
Have you looked over those files?
I played.
Yeah, I did quite a bit. When I wrote Lone Star Country, I used quite a bit of them. But I went down to a...
Where did you see the files?
Well, there's quite a few in the Middle West, but I went down to Girard. You have to look through the appeal to reason. I am aware Oscar Emmeringer's paper is completely on file. It must be somewhere.
What about that labor library that Commons collected at Wisconsin and their latest ship down to Chicago? It's the best,
I guess.
Wouldn't they have Emmeringer's paper?
They have some of them. I don't know if they have a complete file. Duke University now has one of the best labor collections.
There's one hobo poem that I thought you might like. Of course, it's written in the hobo's, what do you call it, Ben?
Vernacular.
Oh, we'll have none of that. This is a respectable place, Harry.
Oh, not necessarily.
Not that respectable.
What do you mean respectable?
This is a respectable joint.
Huh?
This is a respectable joint.
He's talking about a wobbly hobo.
Oh, pardon me.
Something very different.
Let's have it.
Probably full of social significance.
I thought we didn't have any cast,
didn't we? No cast.
You know, don't forget, I'm one of the Sanskalot, you know. I'm one of the ones without trousers, you know. But when they were carrying the head of King Louis the 16th, and the queen, you know, around, they said, don't forget, this is the Sanskalop that's doing the job. And some one of these times, we might not live to see it, but some of our people who, some of our parasites who would prefer that we lived on cake instead of such vulgar things as ham and eggs and beefsteaks and that, they might be in the same position.
Well, let's hear that.
The hobo poem.
The hobo poem.
Oh, I don't know whether... You really want to hear?
Sure.
All right. Picture to yourself this is out on the railroad, down in the desert, you know, somewhere in the south, in Texas. The title of the poem is Down on the Gila Monster Route.
Oh,
that's what they used to call that railroad, you know, among the rails and the hobos and that, the Gila Monster Route is right, oh gosh, down everything that stings and bites and tarantulas, you know, and rattlesnakes and sidewinders and everything.
They took it down around Bisbee where they took 1,000 of them out and dumped them out in the desert.
Yeah.
Miles away.
That's where you find the Gila Monster around.
About 1,200 wobblies were taken out of some town in, I think it was Bisbee, Arizona.
Well, that was the big copper miner strike in 1917.
They were taken out into the desert on flat cars and turned loose in the desert, miles away from any human habitation and left there to
That was the big copper strike in 1917. When the miners, under the leadership of the IWW, struck against the Copper Queen Mining Corporation and the Phelps Dodge Mining Corporation, up to the time...
Harry later worked in San Francisco for years with the lawyer, who was their lawyer there, and later was one of the first labor lawyers in San Francisco, defending the early criminal syndicate.
William Bernard Cleary.
Oh, okay.
He was the one who defended a good many of the IWW men in the around the Bay Area, who, you know, and they
were,
that fat tub of guts, his son, why he bears.
You remember that Cleary?
He's
all right.
He's
you know. He's been involved on the progressive side in some cases, yes.
Well, he certainly changed then because
in Moody case he was working for the state. He was assistant state's attorney general.
And John Lawler, I guess you remember John Lawler, He said to me when that happened, he said, "Good gravy," he says, "Harry," he says, "that's enough to make W.B. turn over in his grave."
What did W.B. say about the copper collar?
Oh, W.B., that is William Bernard Cleary, you know, when he first, he came from a very aristocratic family, one of the old southern families from West Virginia, the Clearys, if you get what I mean. And when he came out, he was a relatively young man out to Arizona, why, and hung his shingle out as a lawyer, why, within no time at all, why, he had more legal work than what he knew what to do with at first. And he often thought how strange it was that some of these cases that almost any, you know, mere beginner from law school who had a shingle, you know, could have taken care of, why they should be coming his way. Until he finally figured the thing out. With his own conscience began to worry him, and he figured the thing out. He told me from this angle, this legal work that they insist on shoving over across my desk comes from either the Copper Queen Mining Company or the Phelps Dodge Mining Corporation, who own everything in the state of Arizona, figuratively speaking and literally speaking to a very great degree. And he said the next time that one of these very polite and personable young men from presumably a lawyer like himself came with a, you know, what they call a briefcase for W.B. to work on. He said Cleary looked it over and he pushed it back across the desk of this young man and he said, "Take it back to your masters and tell them that W.B. Doesn't wear the copper collar." Well, where William Bernard Cleary got that from was he had told me that that was a term that the miners in Bisbee, Arizona used for a lawyer like himself. He had the reputation of being one of the few lawyers that could be found in Bisbee, Arizona, who didn't wear the copper collar. That was
so
the way
the workers came to him. What was his first labor case?
Huh?
It's like your father, Meridell.
Yeah.
Her father was the IWW lawyer in the Harvest region.
No
sure
kidding.
He defended all the wobblies that used to get arrested up and down Minnesota, Dakota, Iowa.
Probably knew Cleary one way or the other.
Yes, I didn't think of that.
Well, how did he get his first labor case?
Well, it was a miner got injured in one of the numerous accidents that happened.
He started out in Arizona,
Well, that's where he really began to blossom out, you know. I mean, where he had practiced law back in Virginia and he migrated west. He hadn't been married so very long then to this Mrs. Cleary, and that's where he really hung out his shingle and began to practice law, was in Bisbee, Arizona. And because he had the reputation among the miners of not wearing the copper collar, the miners came to him in droves, you know. I mean, if they wanted one of them, one time when I was holding the fort over here in the mills building for W.B. while he was out getting a bite to eat or something, he told me, "Anybody comes in, Harry," he said, "tell them I'll be back shortly." So the door opened and a typical working stiff, you know, walked in, had the earmarks, you know, toil written all over him. And he looked around, he says, "Mr. Cleary here?" I said, "No." I said, "He'd be back very shortly." I said, "Sit down, make yourself at home." So we got to talking, and that's the first shot out of the locker that he used. He said, "W.B. is handling a case for me." He said, "And I want to find out how it turned out." And in the course of our conversation, this miner told me, he said, Mr. Curry had a wonderful reputation among the miners in Bisbee, Arizona, and he said all through the state of Arizona, being one lawyer that we miners knew for a certainty didn't wear the copper collar.
Pretty good. But how did they force him out of there?
Oh, well, when the miners, you know, when they walked out from the mines of the Copper Queen and the Pelch Dodge outfit, the strike right from the start, there were 1,700 of them walked out. And, of course, immediately, the Copper Queen and the mining outfit and the Pelch Dodge outfit, why they called on one of their Fink outfits, I think it was the Baldwin Felstugs from Chicago that handled that job, and they came out, and of course they used the customary tactics, you know, of murder or near murder, you know, breaking the picket line up by physical force and by arresting their leaders and clapping them in jail on all sorts of phony charges. Well, you went through the same thing, you know, I mean, back in Lawrence and Passaic and those other places. But it didn't work. And the Finks that they brought in, you know, these hired killers from the Baldwin Fels outfit, why, the only thing they knew how to work with was brass knuckles and guns and blackjacks, and that didn't mine any copper. So eventually, why, in spite of all their terror and everything, in the meantime, the war is going on and no copper is coming out. So they finally resorted to the use of physical force. They brought in these deputy sheriffs and these hired killers they had from this Fink outfit and all these other so-called loyal Americans, and they staged a grand roundup, as they called it, of all the leaders and the strikers, everybody that even looked like a worker, some of them that were even white-collar workers, but who happened to be in the way of these hired killers and these thugs and that, you know, and these deputy sheriffs. If you even looked like a worker, you went along with them, and they shoved them in box cars and on flat cars and everything. They deported, I think, close to about 1,000 of the original 1,700 and went out on strike. And W.B. Cleary was defending a case over in Tombstone, Arizona, on the day that they, rounding up of the miners and their leaders took place. So these thugs, they knew what they were doing. One of them, when they passed by this office where W.B. Cleary had his shingle hanging out, they said, let's get that so-and-so too. So they went up to the office.
No, I feel
like and what did they do? They went up into W.B.'s office, you know. But no W.B. Well, somebody tipped them off that W.B. Cleary was over in Tombstone, Arizona, defending the case. So they deliberately detoured some of these thugs, the mining outfits, and they went 14 miles out of their way. And they met W.B. coming back in the machine with a friend of his coming back from Tombstone, Arizona to Bisbee, and they said, all right, you come along too. So they shoved William Bernard Cleary, this lawyer, into the boxcar along with the miners, and they deported him along with the miners out in the desert wastes of Arizona somewhere.
What happened to them? How did they get there?
Well, eventually, well, of course, most of those, you know, you never saw a bunch of IWW men yet who couldn't figure their way out of some sort of a situation. They just simply made a reappraisal of the situation and formed ranks and slogged on, you know. Eventually, well, they the state authorities and the federal government were forced to take cognizance of a thing like that. They couldn't get away with a thing like that completely, you know. And but they broke the Copper Queen Mining Company and the Phelps Dodge outfit. They achieved their ends. They broke the strike by physical force. The miners got a raise out of it, but any odd number of them, the majority of them that took anywhere near a prominent part in the strike were blacklisted from then on.
And how did Parry happen to come to San Francisco?
Well, he came when he saw that there wasn't, they had served an ultimatum, the gunmen were still running Bisbee.
Have been newspaper special articles written about how when Tom was on trial, his during the day, his he would go for walks in Golden Gate Park and up around the Presidio and places with his with the deputy who was supposed to be guardian, and that he regularly had lunch with his friends.
Oh, I didn't know that.
It was all written up.
Well, it couldn't have been secret.
Well, no, Scott was in charge of it. Yeah, people took pictures and turned them over.
And what does Scott turn out to be?
Tom Mooney walking down on Market Street.
Is he one of their things?
What's on here? He's just walking along like anybody else.
You mean you saw him on Market Street one day?
He had to come up Market sometimes. They'd walk up Market Street.
The deputy would just accompany him.
Just his friend.
People knew the face would look around and think they were seeing ghosts or something, see? We went down then and that's where I got the this motion picture. We made a studio out of this county
thing.
Jail. Right? The sheriff Murphy, whom I ran against in 1935. Sheriff Murphy was very, very nice. For 2 or 3 months, I used to go down every night with a couple of stenographers and sit in Tom's cell and. He'd talk and talk and talk till after midnight, and when one girl would get tired, the other one would take over, and we got the stuff all down. Then out in my house out on the beach, we had a staff of volunteer transcribers, and they came up and transcribed all these notes.
But that wasn't recorded in your voice.
Out of all this stuff, I have a manuscript that thick, see? The whole story of his life, which I boiled down into a 7,000 feet of picture film, which we shot one night in the jail kitchen.
There is no book of the story of Tom Mooney's life.
We talked to him many a time. He said lots of people have approached me, and I don't know why he never wrote the story.
Anybody
of
wants
life.
To write
there must be material. You talk to him like that.
Well, Ben has got.
There should be a book on his life.
Why didn't he? We talked to him. I remember we talked to him in jail. He said, well, some fellow from the magazine in the East was out and wants to do it. And
we wanted
Dreiser. He wouldn't do it.
I persuaded Dreiser to go over to San Quentin and talk to him to write make a book about him. Not a biography, but write a novel based on the Mooney case. And so Dreiser went over and visited Tom. And he came back and he told me, it's too big for me. He says, the thing is too big for me. I can't, he said, I don't know.
Maybe that's it. Everybody feels it's too big. Maybe it's not too big for
you. Like to do
it's like the Rosenberg case now.
It's just too big for me. So Dreiser passed it out.
It would take a tremendous amount of work. You got a novel on it.
Yeah, that should be.
Well, anyway, he during that year, that was quite a time for Tom, and of course they brought out Jimmy Walker came out. All it was publicity. Well,
yes.
What we were working for was to get loads and loads of publicity. So lawyers like Finity in Washington came and volunteered the services, came out at his own expense and appeared in court for
Mayor
week or
Walker.
Two. And then when he had to go back. Jimmy Walker came out and got
Jimmy
the front page headline. Sure, he got
a few words.
He was in court there for 2 or 3 days, I guess, and appeared for Tom, you know, and got that means front everything we did like that would be front page publicity. You know?
If you talk to him at midnight, you must have a
midnight.
So, how about you, Randy?
Oh, that's... Now, let's get this Irish poem. Where is the flag of England?
Where is the flag of England? And the winds of the world made answer. North, south, east, west, wherever there's wealth to covet or lands that can be possessed. Wherever are darker races to cozen, coerce, and scare, you will find that vaunted ensign, aye, the English flag is there. Aye, it waved o'er the blazing hovels whence the African victims fly to be shot by explosive bullets and to wretchedly starve and die. And where the beachcomber harries isles of the southern sea, at the peak of that hellish vessel, 'tis the English flag flies free. Go search for your once glad islands where disease and death are rife, and your question will find its answer, for the English flag is there. Dividends, rent, interest, chicanery, lies, and bag, these are the gods of empire, their symbol the British flag. By guile and craft the lands that laughed now weep neath these strange gods' spell. And if blood be the price of their redemption, Lord God, they've ransomed hell.
That's warm up a little. Well, the reason this it took time to do it, but it was part of the philosophy that the OBU part of the. It came with the structure of the organization. We were different from the IWW, different from any other kind of union. We were built around the central labor councils in each community. And along with our organizing, we didn't care how they organized. They could be organized in craft unions, industrial unions, any kind of union, as long as they were represented democratically on a central labor council, which was all powerful in that community. At any time it could bring into action all the workers in the community that were organized. And along with that, we had to have a policy of getting all of the people, except the bosses themselves, on our side in any struggle. So we had to preach a kind of unionism that would lined up the people against the employer who was involved. And the first day I went into Lawrence in 1920, when they called me up there, I walked up Essex Street, the main street, with a bunch of the fellows that came down the station to meet me. And as we passed by a couple of cops standing in a doorway, a couple of uniformed policemen, I heard one of them say to the other, "There goes the son of a bitch now." So I knew that, first of all, what I did in Lawrence had to be done so that that idea expressed by that remark would be out. And from 1920 until 1922, every time we had one big union meeting of any kind, we emphasized the point that everybody in Lawrence, except the owners of those mills, should be on one side, the owners on the other. See? And it was a kind of a city where practically everybody works in the textile mills, or else the businessmen are dependent on the workers in the textile mills. We went out to get that kind of thing. And by the time the strike began in 1922, we had it. We had it to the extent that before the strike began, we learned that they had prepared, as they always did in Lawrence, to break it by violence right at the beginning. There were two carloads of ammunition, including tear gas bombs and hand grenades, on a siding in the South Lawrence Station. We found out about that. And Marshal O'Brien, the chief of police, was all set to smash the thing in the first few days and make it short and quick. So, on the common the night before the strike began, we decided that we would have to adopt a different strategy from anything that had been done in Lawrence before. In the previous strikes, all these Irish cops and had beaten their heads off the foreigners. So we decided that in the 1922 strike, the Irish and French Canadian workers who had scabbed in previous strikes would have to come out first. And all the other workers of the OBU, there's about 20 different nationalities in the mills, they were under instructions to stay in until all the Irish and American and French Canadian workers were out. And then we would call them out, these unorganized Irish, American, and French Canadian workers who had formerly scabbed had to come out first if they wanted a strike. And when they were out, then the one big union would begin calling out the other nationalities. And so the policemen, the first morning that the picket line began, which was only 2,000 or 3,000 workers in it, and they were all Irish, Americans, French Canadians, down by the Pacific Mill. Marshal O'Brien and his cops were all down there, and they were all prepared for action, and they looked at this picket line, and there were all these friends of theirs in the picket line, no foreigners at all. And we had a little talk. I went over and talked to the marshal. I told him that if he left the picket line alone, there'd be no violence. If his men attacked the picket line, well, we couldn't tell what might happen. So they laid off and waited. The next day, we called out the Polish and Lithuanians, and they were added to the picket line. It took us a week to do it before we got the mills closed down. Each day, a new nationality. The Italians, who had always led the strikes in Lawrence up to then, they were the last to come out, and it was awful hard to keep them in. It was very hard to make the workers understand that strategy, because
the
best organized the cops. By this time, they realized that the thing was not going to work, and one Boston newspaper had printed an editorial, which gave me a big plug. Said something about Leger is a great magnetic leader, and if, as long as he's in control of the situation, it doesn't look like there's going to be any violence in Lawrence. So they were kind of stumped. And in the meantime, here's another thing that contributed to that. The Boston police strike happened during the time that I was first in Lawrence.
Boston had quite a police strike.
I immediately had a committee from the Boston policemen come up to Lawrence, and we had a big mass meeting and presented them to the Lawrence workers, and we took up a terrific big collection, and we had the Boston policemen out with tin cans on the streets in Lawrence with their tin collection cans.
Did you send for coolers to give payday. The other side of the story?
Well, the Boston
I
police...
I don't think I could ever collaborate with cops.
The Boston police strike was...
progressive cops.
While the Boston police strike lasted every payday, Boston policemen with their uniforms on and collection cans, Boston police strike armbands on, were collecting outside the mill gates in Lawrence. And believe me, all those things had a great effect on the Lawrence police force, the members of
because
the Lawrence
the
police
only
force.
Police strike
so that,
right there. When the
strike that began, then after we got the first week of it was over and the workers were out, the mills were tied up, and the policemen, the members of the force, in the meantime, they were already like this fellow that I talked about that came over to me and told me that I could tell the workers that he wasn't going to do any clubbing this year, because they were the ones who had clubbed in 1912 and were being watched by the strikers. Those fellows had bad reputations. And this fellow particularly wanted me to assure the strikers that they could not, they wouldn't expect to see him swinging his club in this strike.
You know,
and so for 6 months, the strike went on. And I think, I don't know statistically whether this is accurate or not, but it probably was one of the least violent strikes in American labor history that involved as many people and lasted so long. We had 20,000 people out on strike for 6 months, and in the entire time, there were only 63 arrests made, and the longest period that anybody spent in jail was one striker got 3 months for cracking a scab over the head with a piece of pipe. Piece of iron pipe. Well, what I used to, on the bandstand in the common, I told him that Joe, whatever his name was, had been, the strike had lasted a long time. He was getting kind of weak and hungry, and he had this big piece of iron pipe. He was carrying it home or something, and it was so heavy that he just couldn't hold it up there, and it kind of accidentally fell on the head of the scab, and the judge took cognizance of that fact, and he realized that it wasn't really intentional, so he only gave him 3 months.
Was there much ideological difference between the IWW and the OBU?
No, not only in structure, that's all.
They didn't fight.
We had a preamble to our constitution that was not quite as outspoken as the and simple as the IWW's, right to the point, but it was the same sort of thing, about the same kind of thing.
But you were in different regions, mostly. You didn't clash.
We worked mostly Canadian, and all the IWW's in Canada went into the OBU. In the United States, in the places where we had an OBU, there were no IWW anymore.
And I didn't hear of the IWW.
In the 1923 convention,
the middle way.
In the 1923 convention in Winnipeg, we passed a resolution to invite the IWW to meet with us in a conference to bring about unity of the two organizations. And that was one of the things that came out of Lawrence, and I sponsored in Winnipeg the